I want to remind you of the cycle of Judges. Dan gave us that great judge, peace, rebellion, oppression, and calling out to God last week. To recap it, Israel is delivered or ruled by a judge. So that's a righteous or godly leader, mostly military leaders or advisors. They have a period of peace and prosperity. They forget about God and reject him. And worse, they adopt the religion and the gods of the people around them, the Canaanite people, the religion of the Baals. That's important for our story tonight. They ultimately come to experience oppression by those people whose gods they've adopted. And then cry out to God, and God raises up a judge, a leader, through which he delivers Israel, his people. And I want you to remember a couple of things as we push deeper into the book, because it's going to get stranger from here. We have to remember that violence described, talked about, and committed by God's people and on God's people is not God's endorsement of violence. Because they are detailed in these texts, it does not give us permission to adopt that kind of a spirituality now. Our God is the Prince of Peace, and his way is the way of peace. That is to say, you don't get to invoke these texts to justify genocide, segregation, racism, or slaughter in the modern geopolitical space. The other thing that we need to remember is that these texts were written at a specific time and a specific place to a specific people for a specific purpose. Now, that is the events detailing about 350 years, roughly 1400 BC to 1100 or 1090 BC, but likely compiled in about 1050 BC, 1050 BC, and probably to build legitimacy for David's monarchy, right? These stories tell the time where Israel had no king. The book is brought together at a time when Israel is getting used to having a king. And that's obvious by the fact that the book keeps saying, in those days, Israel didn't have a king, and everyone just did whatever they wanted. Now, that's important for us because it may be true of you that you remember a time that you did not have a king, that you did not understand Jesus as Lord of your life, and in those days, you did whatever you wanted. In the same way that these texts prepare Israel to have a king, they prepare us and all the world and the church to come into the lordship of Jesus by demonstrating to us what happens when he isn't Lord of our heart. And the third thing for us to keep in mind is that Baal worship is synonymous with child sacrifice. It's easy for us to read the Old Testament, particularly the violent bits, where God's people are told to move into the land and remove the Baal worshippers quite violently, and that doesn't really square with our modern sensibilities. Baal worship is synonymous with child sacrifice. The archaeological record evidences that. The scripture is really clear about that. And what we know from historians of the time in antiquity, they also attest to that. So this isn't just any old people with any old religious practices. This is the practice of child sacrifice, and that should remind us of the tragedy of this book. When Israel abandons their God for the gods of the Baals, when Israel adopts the practices of child sacrifice. They are the state in these books. That is when we pick it up tonight with Jerubbaal, let Baal contend, or Gideon, as he is also known, we see that is why he's the center of the narrative in the book of Judges, the middle story. He gets the most airtime because God is demonstrating in these texts that then and forevermore, he will not abide child sacrifice. Now, that will not answer all of your questions, and it won't resolve all critiques of the challenging moments in these texts, but I hope it helps raise the stakes and help us and encourages us to dig a little deeper. So let's push into Judges 7. So we're going to see four key things happen in Judges 7, and they're really cool. I really love the way that this part of the narrative rolls out. The first thing we're going to see is that God knows and reveals our weakness. Then we're going to see God remind us of his strength and faithfulness. We're going to see our response as being one of worship and faithful action. And then we're going to see the broader community of God respond and join the movement of the kingdom. Let's get into it. God reveals our weakness. In verses 1 to 8, we see Gideon gathered with all of his men, everything that he can bring. A meager offering when you compare it to countless camels and swordsmen, as we hear about in the text. And slowly but surely, God starts to whittle away at even these meager resources. He fronts up with 32,000 men, and God goes, Gideon, you've got a bit too many men here. But it's okay. Just tell everyone that's trembling with fear to go home. And they can. And so Gideon does that, and he thinks 2,000 people will believe. 30 is a nice, even, clean number. But 22,000 soldiers disappear. They leave the battlefield, they leave the army, and Gideon is left with 10,000. And at that point, as Gideon, you're like, whoa, okay, I just lost more than half of what I thought I had to do the thing God has asked me to do. That's okay. There's stories of small armies overcoming big armies all throughout our history. I'm sure it's going to be fine. And then God says, Gideon, you still have too many men. I'll tell you what, take them down to the watering hole and I'll tell you which ones to bring with you. Gideon must be at this point going, oh, okay. I mean, I've come this far. Let's go, okay? So he takes them down to the watering hole. And then God says, the ones that drink the water with their tongues, keep them, and all of the rest, send them home. So Gideon must have been watching as most of his army land on hands and knees and just start drinking, thinking, what have we done? And then, almost arbitrarily, 300 scoop the water and drink it. Now, I've seen commentaries on this that seem to suggest that what God is actually doing here is with the fear, the trembling with fear, God is getting rid of the people that don't want to be there. Because you don't want them in the fighting line, right? They won't have the staying power. And fair enough, I can get on board with that. But then I see people kind of push the envelope a bit. See, what God is doing with the hands, right, is those people had to stay on their feet and they scooped and they're ready for anything. They're still, oh, I'm ready for a battle. But I just don't think the text is trying to do that. I actually think this is just really scary. This is just God. This. Because he knows our weakness. He knows Israel's weakness is pride. It's not fear and it's not lack of preparedness. It's pride. And he says it right at the top. If I don't do this, Gideon, then Israel is going to think that they did it. You see, if Israel is just steps into battle with 32,000 or even 10,000 against an uncountable number of Midianites, then you're going to think you did it. But 300? Well, that can only be me, right? That can only be the Lord. So that's what it's going to be, 300. And at that point, you, Gideon, you started the day with 32,000 fighting men. You've ended that day with 300. And your track record at this point is to doubt and to be afraid. Maybe you're a little fearful and a little bit doubting. Maybe even you're starting to doubt God's character. Maybe you're starting to go, I've been deceived. See, Gideon exists at a time where Israel is not unified. Israel doesn't have a king. They don't have one guy telling them which god to look at and calling all of the shots. It's a tribal society. There are 12 big tribes that are loosely affiliated by blood, but mostly disagree with one another. They all have families within those tribes, and all of those families and tribes have their own practices, their own gods often when they abandon the Lord, and their own alliances and wealth and power and soldiers and way of doing things. This is not a uniform nation. This is a collection of tribes. And all of the tribes around Gideon at this point have gods that are fickle, that demand child sacrifice, that mock and play with humanity, that derive pleasure from deceiving those that worship them. And if you're Gideon, having not known Israel's God, maybe you're starting to think, I've been deceived. This one is just like all the rest, and I'm about to lead 300 men to their death. And almost sensing this, God reminds Gideon, without being asked, of his strength and his faithfulness. You see, in the previous chapter, Gideon asks and asks and asks for confirmation. It's like, I'll make the fleece wet and the ground dry. Now the ground wet and the fleece dry. And eventually, he's in. But at this point, I imagine he's so bewildered that God goes, I see you and I know what you need. And he says, Gideon, it's time to take the army and do the thing. But if you're afraid, head down to the camp with your servant Pura. Pura means coverage, by the way. So covering. And likely he was armor bearer, right? So reading this story as a 1000 BC Israelite, you're going, oh, God covered him as he sent him down there to the thing. And that's just a little cool little tidbit of information for you. But what God is doing is he's sending Gideon down there, and then from the mouth of the enemy, he hears the same plan that God told him, that he will deliver Israel through Gideon's hands. The interpretation of the dream that he spoke is Gideon's going to win the day. God has given it to him. And his response to that reminder, that gentle reminder of God's strength and his faithfulness, is what? Worship and faithful action. Now, I don't know, but I don't think right then on the outskirts of the enemy camp, jumped into loud and electric worship of the God of Israel. I wonder if this is the moment where Gideon's heart of stone melted and became a heart of flesh. That's New Testament imagery for the moment that we see and recognize Jesus as King. I wonder if in that recognition that God was going to do it, Gideon had everything he needed to let go of the past and step into what God is doing today. And so he goes back to the camp and goes, "Let's do it, guys. Let's go. God's given us the day." And so he rallies them all, and instead of shields and spears and swords and slings, he puts in their hands pots and torches and trumpets. Pots and torches and trumpets. The thing I love about this is that God didn't even tell him to do that. The scripture's really clear previously with all of the things that God tells Gideon to do. But when he says, "Go and take the camp," he partners with Gideon in the quirkiness, the creativity, and the innovation that God has already put in him when he was born. He takes what God has already done in Gideon to this point, bringing him to this moment for this thing, and he equips an army of 300 men with pots and torches and horns. And then they break up into three groups and they surround the camp, and then they start smashing the pots and blowing on the horns and saying, "A sword for God and for Gideon." And then fear overcomes the enemy and they flee. And as they flee, as that initial move of God establishes itself, the people of God, the rest of Israel, not all of Israel, but four tribes that we hear about, the tribes that were affected, probably, the ones on the other side, probably didn't have a lot to worry about at this point. But the ones that are affected, Naphtali, Asher, and Manasseh, without being invited, are called out. That called out isn't a, "Hey guys, come and do the thing." It's a, "I see God is doing something, and now we are a part of it." You see, the people that God had sent back to those same three tribes, Manasseh, Naphtali, and Asher, were stirred up with that God was, we were on the precipice of God doing something, and their eyes would have been on it. And as soon as God moved, they were positioned to be able to lead them to join the move of God. And then Gideon sends messages out to Ephraim on the other side of the river and says, "Hey guys, join the move of God." Ephraim, way bigger than Manasseh, way more influential at this time, more money, more soldiers, more bang for their buck. And they take all of this land, they cut off their retreat, and they kill two leaders of the enemy, the wolf and the raven. And then, we're going to get into this next week, but then they complain about not being invited in at the ground level. And I want you to hold on to that. What happens when a move of God moves through somewhere, and then those with the biggest armies, most money, the most people and resources, just wait. And when they get involved, what's in the heart when they complain about not being brought in on the ground level? But that's next week. This week, Israel is on the verge of being delivered. People have joined the move of God now, and so let's recap it. God knows and reveals our weakness. He reminds us of his strength. He calls us into worship and faithful action. And then the people of God join the movement of God. So what on earth do we learn for us from this story? Gideon's work is done, right? The book of Judges is done. The Old Testament served to bring Jesus to the earth, and he came, and he died, and he rose again, and he ascended into heaven, and he established the eternal kingdom. And then the church was founded. And you are part of that church. That thing that is supposed to look like Jesus and help people know Jesus and tell the world about Jesus. What does Gideon's story mean for us? Not just us as the church, but us right here, right now, as 6 p.m. 6 p.m. at St. Hilary's. When I came here in 2021, 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago, I joined a big staff team that was ministering to big congregations. And the 6 p.m. service alone, I was given a list that was 120 people long, 70 young adults, 20 more on the periphery that were kind of in and out and umming and ahhing. We had leaders of ministries like our youth ministry and children's and families ministry, connect group ministries, were all young adults. We had two youth cohorts of 20 plus, and the 6 p.m. community in particular seemed eager to just get on with the work of the kingdom of God. And then in 2021, we had about another 150 days of lockdown. The roof fell in. And little by little, we started to see the people that we know and we love leave. Some of them really arbitrarily. I bought a house over here and it's way too far. I got married to a Baptist minister and she leads a congregation in Mordialloc. So I'm going to leave. I have to go back to the UK. I am moving to New South Wales. Like, all of these reasons are really good reasons to leave a church community. We saw beloved staff leave. People we love dearly that invested deeply into our community, seemingly arbitrarily, gone from the community. And that's not to mention those that we look around and simply don't see anymore. Those that perhaps just didn't want to be here. And it's easy to sit here and think about that like defeat. To think we're staring at the end, at a slaughter. 300 versus an uncountable number. But what if God is preparing us for the next iteration of the thing that he is calling this community to become? And what if God knows our weakness? See, because Israel's weakness was pride, right? And dare I say it, I think ours is probably pride too. If Israel had been given a military victory, 32,000 or 10,000, didn't matter, they would have done it. But if we had stepped into 2021 and just discovered the new it thing in youth and young adults ministry, the story we told about ourselves would be, of course we did, we're victories. But that's not the story God wants us to tell. We tell beautiful stories about ourselves. We tell incredible stories of generosity, of kindness, of hospitality, I hope you've heard stories of the refugees that we were able to help come into the country and establish in community in Dandenong. I hope you've been seeing what the community's been able to do through the food drive. And I hope you've been encouraged by the stories of you all growing to love and know Jesus. But we also tell another story about ourselves. We tell a story of us kind of being like the original gangsters of the Melbourne Anglican Diocese, right? And that statement is going to need a bit of qualifying. So here we go. If you don't know, this is how we got here. In the 1890s, a guy went, there needs to be a Bible-believing church in Kew. So he bought the land, he gave it to the diocese, but there was already a church in Kew. So the diocese sold it. And then that same guy bought the same land again and put a church on it. And that is the dopest story I've ever heard. It's really awesome. But we can sometimes characterize ourselves as a bit of a thorn in the side of the diocese, as a bit of a, we're going to do it anyway. And those of you that have been around long enough are the ones giggling right now, right? Because you know that we do it. We've all heard stories. We used to have 150 kids in the youth ministry. Sunday Night Live used to be huge. We were the first ones to use a guitar in the Anglican Church in worship. We were the first ones to employ a youth minister. And that is really, really good stuff. But when that becomes the story we tell about ourselves, that we did it, that it was by any stretch of the imagination, a thing that we uniquely did on our own, in our own strength, there comes a point when God can't use that story anymore. And I think that God is preparing us for the next version of the thing that He is doing. We don't have 32,000 soldiers. We don't even have 10. We have less than half of what we started this thing with in 2021. And I say, God, bring it on. Because right now I know it feels like we are camped in the evening at the spring of Harrod. Interestingly, that spring is the spring of fear. I know it could look like defeat now. So we need to be encouraged. We need to be reminded of the faithfulness and of the strength of God. We need to be recognizing the character of the one we serve. Gideon needed confirmation of a military victory, and that's what he got. But we don't need that. That's not our mandate. So what is? What are we here to do? Well, you can answer that question in a whole number of different ways, but simply put, we're here to love God with all of our heart, all of our soul, all of our mind, and all of our strength. And we are here to love one another and others the way we love ourselves. We're here to make disciples of all nations, teaching them all of the things that we are learning and growing in about Jesus. And we're to baptize them to come and follow Him too. And do you know what? I'm encouraged. Because what I see and the stories that I hear as we move ever on into the future are stories of God at work in the hearts of our people. The young adult community is now fully responsible for the social and communal aspects of what it does. Because two people went, oh, this is really important. If we're going to actually connect and know each other and love each other, we have to create some spaces that we can just come and be. And that is a work that God is doing in someone's heart. And my prayer for that is that just continues to open up, that continues for more and more people to be emboldened and strengthened in their faith and their relationships, that they might just come and be. We have young adults, a young adult, opening her home from 9:30 to 11:30 every Saturday morning when she could be sleeping in because she is desperate to explore and serve in hospitality. She is desperate to give out of that thing and just let God shape. She might not even articulate it like that, but that is what the Spirit is doing. My prayer for that is that we all catch that, that we all clock in to hospitality as being the thing that loves the stranger, that brings in the outsider, and that we just start doing some stuff. We have older people taking more and more of an interest in youth and young adult ministry. That's always happened here, and it still happens. We have people leading connect groups for our young adults, and they're just trying stuff, and they're seeing the fruit of God at work in the young people that they lead and serve. And we had one young adult couple get married last year, two get married this year, and at least one is going to get married next year. Eight people in our community have gone, do you know what? I'm going to reject the cultural norm and expectation of what relationship should look like. I'm going to commit to love one person faithfully for the rest of my life. That's the Spirit at work. I'm encouraged. I hope you are too. So look for the things and tell the stories of God at work, of the Spirit moving in your midst. Make spiritual conversations normal. Ask one another, what is God doing in your life? And figure out how to answer it. And then do the weird thing. Rocking up to battle with clay pots, torches, and trumpets isn't the done thing. It's pretty weird. But the Lord was in it. So if you're sitting there going, all right, here I am. If you are in this room, you are one of the people that God has chosen to be part of the next thing. So do the weird thing. If you've got a weird thing, come and talk to me about it. Or just do it. If it's got legs, then we'll get it happening. But if you don't, join someone else's weird thing. Get involved. And I promise you, as we prayerfully and faithfully worship and act, as we move forward, the people of God will join in on the move of God. But it will start here, in this room, because if it doesn't, we'll think we did it, and God won't get the glory. So be blessed, and look for God at work in your life and in the lives of those around you. I'm going to pray.